It's Ask the Pastor time, second hour of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rathert. Thank you for joining us here today. Telephone numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Our guest today here on our Bible study program is Pastor Don Moore, pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Apopka, Florida, where some of us would rather be right now. Morning, Pastor.
Good morning.
What's the temperature there?
50.
50?
50.
So you're having a little bit of a cold snap there.
A little bit. It's supposed to freeze here tonight.
Really? Is that got everybody on edge?
Well, it bothers this particular neighborhood is a lot of nurseries and orange fields, and they get pretty nervous when you say freeze.
Are they gearing up to try to protect the crop, or what's the situation?
Well, they'll be careful about it. It's not supposed to be a real bad freeze, so I don't think it'll be a big problem, but they'll be careful about it.
So for those of us up here for whom nothing is alive, as I shouldn't say alive, but nothing, everything is dormant.
Yeah.
You know, the grass is not green and the trees don't have any leaves and no flowers. What's it like in Florida? Is it fully alive in Florida, or do you have a downtime there too?
Well, it's a little bit complicated here with the trees because they're not real seasonal. Some of the trees lose all their leaves right now in the wintertime, and a lot of them do not. The oranges are hanging off the trees right now. They're in full fruit, and a lot of the other citrus stuff is that way. It's pretty green most of the time, and I guess they've got to cut the grass once a month or so. So I guess it's different.
Now, divine intervention notwithstanding, if you were to get a call to North Dakota, would you go?
Well, you know, I have told my wife that I could probably be just fine living in a Frigidaire box anywhere, but she has a different mindset. She gets very ill when it gets cold, and I don't think she'd take it well up there. So I don't think I'd go there.
At this hour, Pastor Moore, the American people are, can I use this term, installing or inaugurating a new president.
Yeah.
And whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, a liberal, or a conservative, I really think you have to be impressed with the peaceful transition of power that we have in this country and that we have enjoyed for all these many years. Is that a gift from God?
Oh, I would say it is, yes.
Well, yeah. You know, there's a lot of folks who think God just confines himself to the church side of the church and state separation.
Yeah.
And might be surprised to hear you say that.
Well, you know, it's not like God isn't paying attention. And there's some biblical evidence that that is what he desires for us, is to have that quiet and peaceable life, because he is a God of order, and he prefers it for us so that we can enjoy our lives with him in a little easier way and spread the gospel in a little easier way. So I would say he's definitely got his hands on this.
I have not, I was not able to listen, obviously I've been on the air, but it's my understanding that Pastor Rick Warren, in praying the invocation, is that the proper term?
I'd say yes.
The opening prayer to the inaugural festivities there, did pray in Jesus' name.
Good.
That's a good thing in your mind?
Sure. I think he was expected to do that. There was some controversy about him being chosen for that invocation job, because the more liberal side of things in politics really didn't want him to have it, because he's pretty conservative by and large. So I kind of expected that he would do that.
And for those people who might have been offended by that, and it's my understanding, according to news reports, that there may be as many as 2 million people packed into Washington to personally witness the inauguration of Barack Obama, there's probably somebody in that crowd who was offended by that. What do you have to say to them?
Well, I don't know what I would say to them. I guess I would say that it is not intended to be offensive. It certainly has nothing in it that's offensive. It's just that it's a pretty common thing for people to be offended at Jesus because of who he is and what he has done. And they don't like crosses. They don't like to hear about their sins. They don't want to know about the things that he did in any strong, forthcoming way. And even if you're winsome about it, some people are going to get mad at you. It's just a hard thing to deal with.
Barack Obama campaigned with a number of themes. One of them was hope. And a lot of people who are watching the events of this day are doing it through very hopeful eyes. Are you hopeful, Pastor, as we turn this page in our history?
Well, sure, I'm hopeful. I guess... In my own mind, though, I would say that what they're talking about and what I'm talking about wouldn't necessarily be the same thing.
Let's start here. What is it that you think they are talking about?
Well, the discussion of hope in this political realm was hope that things will change in politics and in the leadership of government that will benefit people. And that might happen. I don't know if it'll happen or not, but it might happen. If it does, that would be a good thing. But it's not a lasting hope because, you know, in 4 years we're going to go through all this politics stuff again and we're going to be dealing with new candidates or maybe the same one again. But sooner or later you get a different person there. Are we going to have the same hope? I suspect that some people will and some people won't, same as it is now. That hope is... limited. It's not very powerful, and it can't possibly take them anywhere past 4 or 5 years, or you know, 8 at tops, even if everything goes really well. So I would say that hope is maybe nice, but not very helpful. The hope I'm talking about is eternal, and that has nothing to do with politics or the status of a single man, or even if it is a positive thing that he stands there and does everything perfectly. I don't have a lot of hope that everything will be perfect just because there's a lot of other people in the world, and they all sin, and things go badly sometimes. So I'm not going to lay a lot of hope there. I'm trying to be positive about the whole thing, but I wouldn't call what I have said about that hope.
So when you use the term hope in a biblical way, as opposed to everyday use of the term hope in the world, how is your perspective on hope different?
Well, hope for me is not hope in a vacuum. The kind of hope that you're talking about in a secular world lays hope in a place where there's no good, solid evidence that it's going to work. And even if there is good, solid evidence that it's going to give them some benefit, there's also good, solid evidence that it won't. So that kind of hope, it might be pleasant in some kind of way, but it's not positive enough to carry people's souls to heaven. And it's not really, even as I say, going to carry them for very long, even if everything goes really well, because you're placing hope in limited human beings who sin. Now, the kind of hope I'm talking about is the hope of eternity, and that kind of hope is certainty. It's not hope for something that might or might not happen. It's hope for something that will happen, that's been promised, that has been guaranteed in the blood of the Son of the Living God. There's no way for that not to work, and that is an absolute hope that can't fail. That's very different.
So is it possible for your perspective on hope as a Christian to influence or affect your hope as a person who has to make his place in the world? Do you have temporal hopes as well as your eternal hope? Do they mix in any way, or are they entirely separate?
I would say they're entirely connected, if they're real. The hopes that I have are based on the promises of God. he says that he will look after me and those things that I love. He will protect me in this life. He will help me live in abundance. But he also promises me that I will suffer and that things are not going to go well all the time because I sin and because there's discipline and because there are hard things that happen. But he will be with me in those things, help me through them, and carry me in those hopes all the way to the end of time in his arms. And so everything that I do in this life carries that eternal hope, and the other promises that are connected to that carry me through the issues of the day.
All right, let's turn the corner here. I want to raise another question with you. This actually is a story that came out of the last month. And my memory escapes me here. Am I correct that you had either a military or law enforcement connection at some point in your time?
Kind of both. I was in the Coast Guard, and I was mostly chasing drug smugglers.
That's right.
Illegal aliens and that kind of stuff.
Well, the story is, and I saved this for you because it seemed to me like maybe this was something that you could comment on with some authority, having chased bad guys. This came from the AP in back in December. And the story is, it says, there's more than one way to catch a fugitive. Turns out a promise of extra holiday cash makes an effective trap this time of year. That is Christmas time. Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart said Sunday that a fugitive sweep led to the arrest of 230 suspects on warrants for forgery, aggravated battery, and other crimes. More than 60 of those suspects fell for a ruse with a holiday theme. They got invitations to take part in a survey to help retailers figure out the needs of holiday shoppers. Included was a scratch-off card redeemable for at least $500 if they brought it along to the hotel where the survey would be conducted. Those who showed up were taken into custody. One of the fugitives arrived with marijuana in his pocket. Possession of cannabis was added to his other charges. Is it fair? Is it honest, Pastor, to use what the story calls here a ruse to lure people into a trap like this and arrest them? Is that ethical?
I would say it is. They're fugitives. They're hard to find very often because they hide, and sometimes they have lots of help. You don't want them wandering in the street. It does them no physical or lasting harm to do this thing, and the purpose of it is law enforcement. So I would say that it's just fine.
And what would you say to somebody who thinks that, you know, if they've committed crimes, if they've been dishonest, if they've broken the law, things like that, primarily to have been dishonest in their behavior, that does not justify dishonesty on the part of the authorities, creating the impression of one thing in order to lure them in and then revealing the fact that, well, this is not what you thought it was, hey, you're under arrest. And that, by definition, is dishonest and therefore unethical. The authorities ought to be above that. What would you say?
I'd say that's sour grapes. I mean, there are some things that should not be done. There are entrapment laws, but see, those things are designed to protect people from being caught in a crime that's been designed by someone else to catch them in a crime. That is a problem. That's where you actually create the environment to crime, encourage the crime, and then when they commit the crime, you arrest them. That's a problem. But you know, people get deceived in all kinds of ways to keep them from being a problem to society, and I don't really see a big problem with it as long as there's no harm done and you don't catch something that isn't, created by law enforcement. that's, of course, just an opinion, and there's not a lot to work with in Scripture about it.
Well, what would you say to somebody who says, you know, I understand the practicality of that argument. I understand that this is a way to nab wrongdoers and to put them under arrest, see to it that they pay for the crimes they have committed. I'm not put off so much by the practical argument, but I'm surprised that you would make that argument, Pastor. You're not just a Christian. You're a Christian pastor.
Right.
And you have to think and operate at a higher level than just the practical level. So I'm surprised to hear it coming from you. What would you say?
Well, one of the things that occurs to me when I talk about things like this is that it's much gentler than the alternative. You know, if you're going to send somebody some mail, you kind of know where they are, or at least where they might be found at some point or other. But when you go and knock on a criminal's door, a lot of times they get hurt, and police officers get hurt. This is a gentle thing, and it doesn't hurt. And I'll bet you anything that they probably laugh about it for a little while because it's so silly. And it's I'd say it's a humane thing to do instead of actually risking harm. So I don't have too much sympathy for the argument.
All right, let's head for another direction here. You have young children, do you not? I know you have kind of like an older set of children, a younger set, correct?
Yeah, right.
And how old are the younger ones?
I'm going to turn 4 and 5 here in the next couple of months.
Boys, girls?
Boys.
2 boys.
Yeah.
Well, this is kind of on that yucky side of the center of the equation, but it bears dealing with, I think. Here in the city of St. Louis in the last week, we learned that this city, where our radio station is located, leads the nation in sexually transmitted diseases, way up in St. Louis. Not a distinction that the people here in this city are too terribly proud of. In Atlanta, a story on the Associated Press has come out, and it says the increase in chlamydia, sometimes symptomless infection, that can lead to infertility in women is likely because of better screening, experts said. In 2007, there were 1.1 million cases, the most ever reported, according to officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thousands of women became infertile or become infertile each year because of untreated chlamydia and gonorrhea infections, according to Dr. John M. Douglas, Jr., director of the CDC's Division of STD Prevention. Syphilis cases, which number only in the thousands, also rose modestly, while the number of gonorrhea cases remained roughly the same. Syphilis can kill if left untreated, but chlamydia and gonorrhea are not life-threatening. Chlamydia can infect men as well as women, but rates are nearly 3 times higher for women. That's at least partly due to 1993 federal recommendations that emphasize testing for sexually active women aged 25 and under. This reality threatens your little children. And I know that you as a dad and a pastor are watching out for them and taking care of them. But there will come a time when that care and that protection will reach only so far. Is this something that's on your radar screen, Pastor? Not only because you have little children, but you have people who are at risk now in your congregation? Or is that just a dirty part of worldly existence that better left to other folks?
Well, it's a part of the immorality of the world, and it does affect people. And it's a particularly big draw these days for sex outside of marriage because it's become so permissible in society because we've gotten so godless lately. I know it's an issue. I do talk about it a little bit, even in a sermon occasionally. Because
really? In a sermon?
Yeah, just this past week I did.
And how is that received generally, or do you even know?
Well, people know it's relevant and it's disturbing. I don't think I got any specific reactions about it this week, but they know it's real and that it's important. And there are people on the edges of families in churches. There are people in churches that are having trouble with this kind of thing. So it matters.
Well, sexual immorality, which is, by my count, I Googled this the other day to see how many times that term showed up in the New Testament and the Old Testament. I think it's like 19 times. So the Bible does have something to say about sexual immorality, particularly in the New Testament.
They use different words in the Old Testament, but it's there all over the place.
Immoral sexual conduct is faith-threatening, is it not?
Yes.
And it can send you to hell. Now, what is the best approach here? If you want to convince people that sexually immoral behavior is not a good idea, are you going to talk to them about hell, or are you going to talk to them about chlamydia first? Which of those two?
I wasn't talking about either one of those on Sunday.
Well, so there's a third option. What would that be?
Well, I did. Hell came up, obviously, but the thing that the New Testament talks about is, and this was a part of the text that this past Sunday.
Is that 1 Corinthians 6?
Yes.
Yeah.
Where it speaks directly to your physical body. Your body is not your own. And when you are sexually immoral, especially as a Christian, you bring sexual immorality into the body of Christ. So a lot of times when I'm getting into this, especially with Christians, I guess really only with Christians can you go this way, you tell people who they are, remind them who they are and how they're connected to Christ and how they're connected to the body and how what they do affects the church. Aside from affecting themselves, their body is not their own. So it affects marriages now, it affects marriages in the future, it affects their children, it affects their church, it affects their eternity. And they need to know it in that kind of light.
None of those consequences seem to be putting brakes on any of this.
Well, I think it does if it's spoken of that frankly. Because if you're a Christian, a lot of times just remembering you were baptized into his name makes a difference. All sin is a problem. That sin isn't any different. Well, it is in a certain sense, as Paul brings up, because when you commit a sexual immorality against your own body, you're bringing it against Christ himself and the church. But, of course, that whole book is like that. Everything that occurs in there, it comes against the church and causes disunity. Sin does that when you're a Christian. But it's just sin has to be brought to light. It's the same thing that you see in that chapter of 1 John that you looked at just a little bit ago. If you claim to be without sin, whether it's that sin or any other sin, if you claim it is not sin and God says it is, then you're just lying to yourself, and you're placing yourself in danger. You need to hear the Word of God, know what is truly sin and what isn't, accept that we're sinners, and repent of it.
We have a story coming out of Cincinnati we'll deal with on the other side, which is along this vein here on our Ask the Pastor Bible study. Our numbers are 505-780-5100 1-800-730-2727, and we'll be right back.
As you can no doubt well imagine, when you've been in the same building for as long as AM 850 KFUO has, there are a lot of telephone extensions and lines established for different reasons. And we hope we're making things a little easier by adding just one more. If you'd like to contact anyone for any reason at AM 850 KFUO, remember the phone number 1-888-4-KFUO-AM. That's 1-888, the number 4, and KFUO-AM. And save it in your cell phone book.
How would you like to party where it's 85 degrees in St. Louis? Well, shed your scarf, cast off your coat, and say goodbye to your gloves at the 6th annual Hot, Hot, Hot Family Fun Weekend at the Sophia M. Sachs Butterfly House. Listen to live steel drum music, build sandcastles in the toddler sandbox, and enjoy games and crafts sure to shake off winter's chill. Activities are Saturday and Sunday, January 24th and 25th, from 11 till 2 at the Butterfly House.
Were you once a fish? The answer is next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
In 1866, a German scientist and strong supporter of Darwin, Ernst Haeckel, got into trouble for faking evidence. He supposedly showed that developing embryos go through the earlier evolutionary stages of their species. The scientific community investigated his so-called discovery and found that he had faked his drawings. Unfortunately, textbooks today, well over a century later, still present this faked evidence in support of evolution. As a result, many people today still believe this false scientific theory. One of the most widely used evidences used to support this idea today is the claim that the developing human fetus has gill slits at one point in its development. In fact, a United States ambassador used this argument in support of abortion in a recent issue of National Review. The truth is, the developing fetus has folds of skin around its neck which contain the developing organs which are found in the neck. These folds have nothing in common with gills. While no scientist today accepts this theory, it can still be found in textbooks used by high school students. Why? It would seem that few scientists have the courage to challenge this idea which they know is wrong, because it would make them appear that they oppose evolution. And even worse is that this anti-scientific idea continues to be used as a scientific justification for abortion. The wrong view on origins can result in some disastrous science as well as much human suffering.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE and join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Time and time again, the distinctions between law and gospel result in finding paradox after paradox in the Bible. The call of Matthew by Jesus to be his disciple is no exception. On the next broadcast, we will not only examine the paradox, but also find a kernel of truth in how God decided to call you.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Faith in the Midst of the Jungle, the Women's Day of Renewal 9 will be held Saturday, March 7th at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois. The keynote speaker, Elaine Bickel, will help her audience focus on faith in God as our only source of peace and confidence as we navigate through the jungle in which we live. You'll be able to personalize your experience with two workshops. There is a cost to attend. For more information, visit goodshepherdcollinsville.org or call Good Shepherd Lutheran Church and find out more.
Listen to the Bible study and the Ask the Pastor Bible study. Tomorrow we will move into 1 John chapter 2 with Pastor David Boyce Clare, and our Ask the Pastor guest will be the Reverend Andrew Whaley of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Plano, Texas. Today we're chatting with Pastor Don Moore, who is not quite teeth chattering here today, down to 50 degrees in Apopka, Florida. St. Paul Lutheran Church, where he is the pastor, dealing with some of the gritty issues that we all face here in our culture, particularly the increase in sexually transmitted diseases, which I think on the surface, a lot of people say, well, you know, that's not a big deal. You go get a shot and get it all taken care of. If it weren't for the fact, as it says here in this story out of Atlanta, that thousands of women become infertile every year because of their indifference towards sexually transmitted diseases. Now comes a story out of Cincinnati. This is a little bit more recent. And it says here, teens are taking nude photos of themselves or others, sending them on their cell phones or posting them online. Some teens do it as a joke. For others, it's the new bold pickup line to get a date. I can't believe I'm saying this. I can't believe this is true, but that's what the story says. It is called not texting, but sexting. A year ago, a 19-year-old Goshen cheerleading coach was charged and prosecuted for a misdemeanor contributing to the unruliness of a child for taking a topless photo of herself and a 15-year-old girl. A Glen Est middle school boy was taken to juvenile court during the last school year for taking explicit photos of his girlfriend. The National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy and CosmoGirl.com last month revealed results of a study that showed 20% of teens say they have sent or posted nude or semi-nude pictures or video of themselves. And you have 4- and 5-year-old kids who in 8 to 10 years are going to experience the hormones kick in, Pastor. And 8 to 10 years from now, I don't know where this is going to be. So what are you thinking about this challenge?
Well, I think like any father that's trying to pay attention, at their age right now, I have other concerns, but, you know, future holds a lot. And I guess what I would say about it is training at this moment matters. One of the things that you need to do as a parent, and, you know, God tells us that he does this for us, is discipline. It's not discipline as in punishment that I'm talking about, but it's more like discipleship. When you take up looking after someone and they're under your discipline, then your intention is to keep them on a good path. And so you give them the guidelines, you teach them, and when they go off of them, you try to put them back. And eventually what you hope is that the discipline that you have laid on them becomes their own self-discipline, and then it keeps them out of harm's way as the future goes. And that's certainly true with what we try to do with our children, and I'm trying to do that now. So hopefully when they're out of sight in a few years, far too often from my own concerns, but I know what happens. When that happens, then they're going to have to fend for themselves to some extent, and I hope that they'll take that discipline to heart and make it work. Pray for them an awful lot, and pray for wisdom for myself, and hopefully God will be looking after things for me.
I guess, I don't know if this is fair or not, but I guess when some of us think about the typical congregation down in Florida, we assume that Florida is a kind of a retirees state, that people who have retired, older people, they head for Florida. Those people who are living in other places certainly head for Florida in the wintertime. And so your congregation, I'm going to assume, is dominated by older people who are not too terribly threatened by all this reality here, and that there are fewer than more kids in your congregation. Would that be a correct or a false assumption?
No, that's true.
That is true.
Yeah.
So, do you have teenagers? Are you crossing paths with teenagers as a pastor, if no more than a handful?
Yes. Oh, sure.
And do you have opportunity to raise an issue like this with them?
I do. Well, it's a pretty important thing to make sure you raise it with them if you have opportunity. Confirmation classes, et cetera, or any environment where you have time with them. And I make sure that that comes up. But I think one of the mistakes you're making is that this is a problem for older people, too. They come into an environment where the people that they see are new. Many of them are single because of loss of a spouse, and of course that temptation comes back, and I've had that conversation with them too.
And what do they say, the older people?
Well, some of them have real struggles with it, and some of them come to me with that struggle, and all you can do is encourage them to do what they know is right, and make sure they do know what is right. Forgive them for the things that they mess up on. That's what you do for anyone that comes through here.
Here's another story. This one comes from the United Kingdom. And some folks are saying if you want to know where the United States is going to be in 10 years, just look at Europe. I don't know if that's fair or not. This is written by Nicole Martin. Comes from the Telegraph in England. So this is not necessarily a fit for America, but maybe a prognostication of where we're headed. And the story says a change in attitudes towards sex over the past 10 years has led to a rise in promiscuity, an increase in the use of prostitutes, and a surge in sexually transmitted diseases among young people. The number of men who have paid for sex in the past 5 years has more than doubled, from 1 in 48 in 1990 to 1 in 23 last year. For men in London, the figure is 1 in 11. according to a study of sexual behavior in Britain which was published recently. It finds that Britons increasingly prefer to have a number of sexual relationships rather than marry, with 1 in 12 men and 1 in 28 women saying that they have slept with more than 10 different people in the past 5 years. For people aged 25 to 34, more than 4 in 10 men and 1 in 5 women say that they have had sex with more than 10 different people in their lifetime, according to the Second National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles, which questioned over 11,000 people aged 16 to 44. If that's where we're headed, Pastor, it sounds like we're losing this battle. Is that your view?
Well, I don't know. I see, I don't think like that, winning and losing exactly. I guess I always figure I'm always in the battle. And that battle doesn't stop. You know, you come closer or farther away from what's good, but because there's always sin in the world and people don't like God much, just in general, or else he wouldn't have so much work to do. We wouldn't have so much work to do. You kind of understand that Europe has been on a track of separating themselves from godliness to humanism. They've been on that track for a really long time. Not so long here, but the fruit is starting to come from that, and that's the reason why you've got those other articles in front of you. I'd say you're probably right about that being our future if something doesn't change, but that doesn't mean it can't change. People turn to God, and their lives change, and they don't run down that road so fast, and they take second looks about whether they should be going where they're trying to go, realizing that they sin, realizing that they can see moral things a little better, and turn to a different path. This is the task that we have at hand. It has always been so. It's not going to change, except maybe in intensity. But I wouldn't say winning or losing the war, because the war is won.
I think it's discouraging to hear you say that the problem of promiscuity is, if I understood you correctly, on the rise among older people, and that I would be wrong to assume that this is a problem that is more or less confined to younger people. Well, that's discouraging, because if we are in a battle, and if we are going to somehow turn the tide against this battle, which is leaving women infertile and creating all kinds of problems with sexually transmitted disease, not to mention abortions and all of the trauma that goes along with that kind of a problem, you would like to think that the older folks, perhaps whose morals have not deteriorated along with the culture, and whose experience has taught them that flirting with dangerous things is not a very good idea, you would think that the older folks would be your first ally. But it sounds like that's eroding too, and I find that discouraging.
Yeah, well, it is a little bit discouraging. I wouldn't say it's as predominant with them, because they have different roots. But the problem is, when you are not with family, you act differently. When you're not with longtime friends, you act differently. As a lot of the social structure that controls your behavior goes away. And standing away from those stabilities, you get instability, and then people get into trouble. But on the other hand, I would still say that for the most part, older people are more stable. Most of them are married or committed in some kind of way, just because of the way their lives have been led. And, you know, that's good. So they're helpful, especially to young people who don't have those evidences right in front of them from the past errors. But I don't think you should be discouraged about it so much as just recognizing the truth and keeping at it. I mean, this is one of those things that changed for our country in a lot of ways, and I try to have this conversation with people all the time. We don't think the way we used to think in church. It used to be that people just came to church because that's what people did, and it affected lives appropriately. But it's not really so anymore, because those same older people that are supposed to be more stable are not doing that. They're not bringing their children. They're not bringing their grandchildren. They're not affecting them in the same way. And so people are becoming more secular-minded, more humanistic. and it affects things after a time. But that battle is always ongoing. Right now, it's not going very well. But on the other hand, when people hit bottom and they find out that that's not working, then they're very much ready for Christ to come. So we have that battle. We've just kind of gone around a corner. We're not so much just a welcoming committee at church. We have to be missionaries and help people see the truth because they're not hearing it anywhere else.
We'd like to think that if we could turn the tide against increasing promiscuity and all the consequences that go along with that, you'd like to think that you could do that at a grassroots level, that from pastor to pastor and pulpit to pulpit, pastors could get the word of God out so as to change our direction. But the other day I had some audio on our Ask the Pastor program here that was on Oprah Winfrey's Spirituality 101 program, where she had two clergymen who affirmed that homosexuality is a gift from God. So if the grassroots is disorganized, then I'm not so sure that that's going to work so well. Maybe we need a national figure. Maybe we need somebody who has all the power and presence and charisma of a Billy Graham type of individual who can speak to this in a forceful way and help turn the tide. Do you think that would help?
Well, it'll probably help in their little circle. And even if their circle gets big, there's still going to be great opposition to that because of the way things go. But you never know when God's going to throw some great preacher out into the midst of things and have some great effect. I mean, it happens every once in a while, and I don't know what he's going to do. Those talents lie out there, and sometimes they get used and sometimes they don't, but I think we just have to keep up the struggle and keep on with it. And on the other hand, on the positive side, I see in many ways a greater morality growing out of the youngest people because they, I guess what I see is the ones that have gone into trouble are worse, but there are greater numbers that are not going there. Because they understand the problem is theirs to deal with, and they're starting to work on it. If you go into your religious schools in particular, you see a very moral band of kids there, because they're hearing about God and they're appreciative of that and trying to follow that discipline, which is, after all, what the battle is. So that part's going well, and it's just that the bad part's getting worse.
Well, one thing that seems to have disappeared from the worldly vernacular used to be there, I don't know if it was out of place or not, but was the notion of sin. Now, there is a notion of consequences from a worldly perspective that if you follow a certain course of action, it may lead to consequences that are very or severely difficult. But you can't call it sin anymore, not in the world. Maybe we need a preacher who will kind of wade into that worldly setting and call it sin. Or are you aware of somebody somewhere who's talking about sin?
Well, sure, all the pastors that I know are.
But you're doing it in your churches to people who already know what it is and pretty much agree with what you're saying.
Well, that's pretty much what's happened all this time. And don't make the mistake of them thinking that you're right about this all the time, because sometimes they don't think that. Or if you wouldn't have to tell them. We have to tell them over and over again because you forget. Or you miss something in your life that is broken and you have to be told. That's part of the preaching task, to convince people that they're sinning. But and it has to be done with pastors and with parents and with the people that are responsible for it. If you're going to look for a miracle guy, you might well be disappointed, but it doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It doesn't mean that either that guy won't show up, or even if he doesn't show up, that the tide can be turned. And it happens sometimes that people do better with these things. Even if it's just a small core of people in a community that are very open and obvious, that can have a profound effect on a whole community. And that's what we're supposed to be doing.
All right, one more story here that may fit into the context of your military background. Just get an opinion from you. This comes from the Associated Press out of Topeka, Kansas. It says an atheist soldier suing over prayers at military formations claims a larger pattern of religious discrimination exists in the military, citing attempts to convert Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan and an evangelical bias in a suicide prevention manual. The expanded lawsuit filed by SPC Dustin Chalker and the Military Religious Freedom Foundation in U.S. District Court in Kansas City also claims the military does not take complaints of religious discrimination seriously enough. The Defense Department has identified fewer than 50 complaints about alleged violations of religious freedoms during the past 3 years, with 1.4 million personnel in uniform, according to spokeswoman Eileen Lanez. She declined to comment on a pending lawsuit, but noted that the military has policies against endorsing any religious view. The revised lawsuit criticizes the Army's 2008 manual on suicide prevention, quoting it as promoting religiosity as a necessary part of prevention and describing connectivity to the divine as fundamental. The lawsuit cites comments from a chaplain and a second soldier in Christian missionary publications about attempts to convert Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan, including the two soldiers' desire to distribute Bibles. The lawsuit also notes that in 2007, the Air Force sponsored Team Faith, which performs motocross stunt shows to lead extreme sports athletes to Christ. The original lawsuit filed in September alleged Chalker had to attend events at Fort Riley where Christian prayers were given. Foundation President Mikey Weinstein said Chalker tried to pursue his complaints within the Army but was told they were unfounded. What's your reaction to that story, Pastor?
Well, I don't think anybody can say that the military has become super religious. I remember in my early days when I first went to the academy, talking about late 70s, it was required that every Sunday, every cadet should go to the chapel. And as I was progressing through those 4 years, that really went away.
That is a Christian chapel?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you could go to Catholic or Protestant services according to your choice, and they were very generic, I would say that.
Yeah.
But that was just the way. There were no Muslim chaplains back then. There were Jewish guys, which was another way to go, although we didn't have a rabbi on our campus. And it was a pretty religious thing because everybody realized at the time that it was useful to military people to have religion in their lives. It was useful because it was stabilizing, it was comforting, and it took the edge off of the terribly difficult things that we were all doing. That's changed a lot in the 30 years since I was there. And
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's terrible, but I understand why it's happening. I mean, they have Muslim chaplains, they have Wiccan chaplains, they have, you know, pretty much you name it, chaplains. And, you know, it almost comes to the point sometimes where you might as well not bother with them. Nobody's complaining that the Muslim guys are converting people, and it's just people don't like Christians. It's really just that simple, and they are seen as the greatest threat.
And why do you think that is?
Because they don't like Jesus. We were told in Scripture very clearly that people are offended by him. God has his rules. He's absolute. He doesn't mince words. He calls you a sinner, and you're sort of stuck with it. And unless you pay attention to Jesus, you're going to hell. And, you know, who wants to hear that unless they're ready and willing to accept it as truth? And, you know, I understand why they're mad at us. It hasn't been until very recently that it's been so out of hand in the military. I think it is anyway. But, see, chaplains are still very highly respected there by the soldiers because they understand how important it is. But on the other hand, you're still going to have the guy that gets offended. And, you know, that apparently there is a right nowadays to be not offended. So you get that kind of claim.
Well, I wish the right to not be offended went both ways.
I kind of do, too. It would be
because it doesn't
life-changing.
Seem, it doesn't seem that, any, you know, as a Christian, it doesn't seem that anybody cares particularly whether I'm offended by something.
Right.
I just have to be careful that I don't give offense. It doesn't seem to work both ways. So,
yep.
So what do you think that the court should do with this lawsuit?
Well, since all the soldiers have the freedom to pray or not pray as they see fit, I don't see nobody's making the guy pray. I can promise you that they wouldn't do that. They have a prayer in some environment where he happens to be, and he thinks that that's offensive because it means that he has to pray. Well, he doesn't have to pray. I think the court can say, without even thinking about it, that all the folks there, they have the right to pray and not to pray as they see fit, and that should be the end of the discussion. But it probably won't happen that way because people get all fussy about this stuff.
Not that I'm encouraging you to do this, but if you, former Coast Guard, were to take time to reconnect with the Academy or to somehow express yourself to somebody in the Coast Guard hierarchy, do you think it would matter? Do you think that your opinions on these things would be taken seriously?
Well, I think that they are, and I know that those things are spoken of rather frequently by the chaplains that are in service now. We have many Lutheran chaplains. It's almost certain that Lutherans invented chaplaincy in the military in this country, and I know they're busy.
Well, that's quite a claim.
Well, it's true, though. It goes back a long way. Missouri Synod guys were very instrumental in that, and they're still instrumental in that. There are a lot of Lutheran chaplains out there, and they're very highly desirable because they are they understand government, they understand the role of soldiers, and they understand Christ, and those things are important.
I know the pastor, Kurt Taylor, who is a regular guest here in our Bible study, has served in that role. And when I think he was deployed in Afghanistan maybe a year or so ago, over Christmas time, and actually shared some of his experiences and told some of those stories here on our Ask the Pastor program. It was very moving, and I got the impression from him that for large numbers of people in the military, he didn't have to twist any arms as it pertained to religion. There were more than enough people who sought him out that I think it proves that having chaplains is a good thing.
Well, I think it's true, and soldiers have a tendency to be more on the conservative view of things because it's an all-volunteer service, and they have to recognize what they're doing. And they're facing life and death every day. That'll draw you closer to God an awful lot. And so they're going to be seeking out the chaplains, especially in wartime.
Pastor, good to talk to you. Hope your orange crop stays safe down there. I'd like to have an orange at some point in the future here.
Yeah, well, you won't have to wait too long. They'll be in the trucks soon.
All right. Pastor Don Moore, thank you for the visit.
Thank you.
He is pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Apopka, Florida. Tomorrow we do 1 John chapter 2 with Pastor David Boyce Clare of Faith Lutheran Church in Velda City and Bethesda Lutheran Church in Pine Lawn. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.